This is WUKY 91.3 listener-supported radio. I'm Silas House, and I'm so glad to have the wonderful writer and equally wonderful human being, Ronnie Lundy, in the studio with me today. Ronnie is a native of Corbin, Kentucky, and has written on the music, food, and culture of the Appalachian South for more than three decades. She is a founder of the Southern Foodways Alliance and the Appalachian Food Summit. She's written 10 books, has been a finalist for the IACP Award, and a two-time finalist for a James Beard Award. She now lives in Burnsville, North Carolina. In her newest book, Vittles, she brings the story of Appalachian food, past and present, to life, showing us that Appalachia is a place not just of delicious Southern cooking, but also a place where tradition and modernity live side by side. A place where a new generation of people in food are fighting the stereotypes, reddening what it means to be from the mountains. I'm going to go ahead and say that I think it's the Appalachian Book of the Year. It's a real beauty, and I'm so glad you're here with us today, Ronnie. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Can we do the universal symbol for I'm blushing? That was lovely praise, and I'm delighted to be here. This is just such a treat.
Well, we appreciate it. First of all, the title of your book is spelled V-I-C-T-U-A-L-S. And so most people, especially those who fancy themselves as speaking more properly than others, properly in air quotes, will assume that it's pronounced phonetically, like victuals, I guess.
Right.
But actually, what most people think of as the country pronunciation, which we hear a lot in shows like the Beverly Hillbillies.
Yes.
They say Vittles a lot in that
show.
Yes,
they do.
That is actually the correct pronunciation. So I love that you name the book that, because right away the title is challenging notions of how people perceive our language, our dialect.
Right.
And by that, our culture, our
right.
way of life.
Right.
And often, you know, they will perceive what we're saying to be wrong when more often it's actually the correct way. So
right.
can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I was delighted when I chose this to be my title. And my assumption, I had learned that often we are right in what we say, but I assumed that the pronunciation of Vittles was going to be an alternative pronunciation. And then I looked it up in the dictionary, and lo and behold, we have been right all along. Vittles is how the word was pronounced from the get-go, and sometime probably around the 15th or 16th century in England, they decided that they were going to Latinize a lot mm-hmm. of words. They were going to kind of spiff them up when they spelled them to make them look like they had a better pedigree or something. And so instead of spelling it phonetically, they spelled it V-I-C-T-U-A-L-S. But continue to pronounce it Vittles. Uh-huh. And it's been wonderful. I agree with you. The designer for the book, Stephanie Huntwork, is from West Virginia. And so she got it immediately. Mm-hmm. And as you can see on the cover of the book, she puts the pronunciation right there
yes.
on the cover. Now, the one thing we hadn't counted on is people going into bookstores and saying, I want that book Vittles, and bookstore people saying, we don't have that, but
right.
we do have victuals.
Right.
Would you like to, you know? So, yeah.
Well, I love that. And you do such a great job of talking about that in the beginning of the book. I've asked you
yeah.
to find that page and just read us a little bit of the first page, if you will.
I will. Vittles. Say it the way my people have for centuries. Vittles. Maybe you've seen it spelled V-I-T-T-L-E-S in a cartoon balloon coming from the mouth of Mammy Yoakum. Or heard it as a punchline delivered before Granny Clampett clogs off to roast up a mess of possum. Maybe you thought saying it that way was wrong. But look that word up in your dictionary. It turns out my people, the people of the Southern Appalachian Mountains, have been right about vittles all along. About the way you say them, the way you raise them, the way you cook them, keep them, and share them. About saving seeds and working the land and simmering pole beans and making real cornbread. About the connections between earth and the table and between the table and the people seated around it. Vittles. This is a book that tells about those connections. This is a book about present-day people and places across the southern Appalachian Mountains and the ways their stories link to the past. It's about the foods they make and eat, the gardens they grow, the lives they create. It's a book full of recipes and a book full of voices. To gather them, I drove over 4,000 miles, zigzag on switchbacks, straight along ridge lines, weaving and loping through valleys dark and light, to meet and learn from home cooks and chefs, farmers and shop owners, curers and savers and preservers of both food and traditions. I explored Kentucky, West Virginia, Southern Ohio, Northern Georgia, Tennessee, Virginia, and North Carolina. I searched back through history and joined others in imagining the future. I ate and cooked up a remarkable amount of really good food. This book will take you back on that journey with me.
So some people might see the book on the shelf and just assume that it's a cookbook because it has recipes in it. But it really is much more than that. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I love cookbooks. I love to read about food. But I think this book takes that in new places. It's like it is a book of food writing to the nth degree. You say in that introduction, that's only part of that really wonderful introduction, it's a book full of recipes and a book full of voices. I think we're so used to seeing cookbooks just jam-packed with recipes that it might be surprising to some people to find this is prose-heavy, mm-hmm. and it's has a lot of stories and history and all that in it. So what are you trying to do with Vittles?
Good question.
Because I love what you're doing, but what did you set out to do?
Exactly. I set out there's a genre of cookbook writing that is called variously literary cookbooks or cultural cookbooks, in which stories are told often in the head notes for a recipe, the lead into the recipe, or in the introductions. And my previous cookbooks have usually fallen into that category. And I will tell you what my daughter said when she saw this book for the first time, two things she remarked on. The first was how amazing Charlotte Autry, the food stylist, and Johnny Autry, her husband, the photographer, how beautiful and enticing they made simple food look in the pictures. Yes. And then the second thing she said was, I can't believe they let you write this much.
Right.
But what I had conceived with this book, what I wanted to do was to choose certain foods or traditions, food ways, as it were, that in some way had a deeper resonance with Appalachian life, something that was key to it. And then I wanted to create essays to open each chapter. And so that's what happens. It's not really a chapter opening. Say, for instance, when I talk about corn, I don't just say, you know, corn really mattered a lot. Here's a little about how we grew it. Here's a little about how we cooked it. Here's the recipes. But I talk about the Cherokee, and I talk about the spiritual symbolism of corn to the Cherokee. And I talk about the spiritual and social and economic resonance of corn to the frontier pioneers who didn't have the wherewithal to plant amber fields of grain but could put corn in their pocket and mm-hmm. have a meal very soon. And I talk about how corn becomes a part of moonshine. And there's a segment where Laura Smith talks about growing up in Corbin and how moonshine was a signifier in the community of belonging. And it's interesting, Laura tells a story that she was told about some bad moonshine that caused Jake Leg.
Yes.
In the community many, many years ago. And one of the things that I had to cut out of the book for space reasons was the fact that one of my cousins was injured by that particular moonshine too, and always walked on canes or with a limp. So
right.
So it even connected us, even though Laura is 30 years younger than I am, it connected us over generations. So there's a lot of weaving of story. And I also wanted to use food those of us, many of us in the Southern Foodways Alliance, see food as a way to talk, to look for real history as opposed to the histories we've been given. And
yes.
I kind of refer to, and there's some good history out there, but up until the past 40 to 50 years, I kind of refer to the history of the Appalachians as history as a Yelp review, because it was people coming into the region who had agendas, who didn't really understand what was going on, and who formed opinions and advanced them. And that's what we grew up with. In the last 40 to 45 years, there's been some extraordinary work done by scholars going back to fundamental documents like the census or what was written in newspapers or accountings from shops and businesses, et cetera. And what we begin to see is a very different history of Appalachia revealed. We were much more culturally diverse. This idea that we're all Scotch-Irish and we're all angry is pretty bogus. And if you look at our foodways, you can actually not only see that, you can taste that. So it's it was a way for me to gently open the door to saying, you know, people don't really know who we are. Even we don't really know who we are and where we came from as fully as possible. Mm-hmm. And food is a lovely way to do that. So that was my purpose. That's why there's history in here, even though I hesitate to call myself a historian.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you're from Appalachia, you have a relationship with shame.
Yes.
People shame you in every which way.
Mm-hmm.
And one way that they do that is by shaming your food ways, making fun of what you eat and what you're raised eating. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, thinking about working class food and the connection to shame. And
you know, I was thinking today, I've been very fortunate that this book has garnered a great deal of attention. And a lot of the attention, almost all of it, has been focused on the more serious content of the book. And this is not the first time I have written about Appalachian food or Appalachian foodways, either in a book or in some other context. It is the first time that I have not been asked about possum or squirrel in the very first conversation. And we didn't eat possum. I did eat squirrel growing up. It was delicious, and it certainly made sense in the food ways. But these things are heard by people who are not from the region, things that we take pride in, the fact that we know how to forage and could feed, and we knew all these ways of preserving food that allowed us to feed ourselves all through the winter. Those are things that I take tremendous pride in, and they demonstrate our incredible intelligence. If you look at the methods of gardening and preserving, the fact that all of our gardening took place on a steep slant, you know, you realize that we had to understand sustainable land management, sustainable animal management, sustainable food management. And in the outside world, what we get given back to us is how funny that is. Like, we're doing these things because we don't know any better, or we're lazy, or we don't, you know, we let our hogs forage instead of keeping them in a pen, and that's because we're lazy. No, it's because we live in the most diverse food shed in North America, not just for human beings, but for animals. And those hogs running up and down and eating acorn mast and chestnut mast and the greens that they liked in the mountains make the best tasting ham and bacon and sausage in the universe, I'm pretty sure. I've tasted some mighty, 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 mighty good ham from Italy and Spain and elsewhere, but I have never had one that tastes better than Appalachian country ham.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I always love it when people assume there's something we should be ashamed of when, in fact, it's something that we're very proud of.
Exactly. Exactly.
And that happens a lot, actually.
Right.
Often when I'm being interviewed about something about Appalachia, people will say to me, well, what is there to be proud of, or what gives you hope? And one of the things that I've started talking about lately that gives me hope is this food movement that's happening in Appalachia. And, I mean, you've certainly been at the forefront of that. Will you talk just a little bit about this food movement in the region and how it started?
One of the things that I mention is that I wrote the first proposal, the first draft of the proposal for this book in 2008. And it took me 6 years before I found the editor and the publishing company that got it. It was absolutely worth every moment of the wait. I sing the praises of Frances Lamb as my editor, and Clarkson Potter has been behind this book 100%. But what I saw in 2008, I had lived for a little while in West Asheville, and I was living out west. I have these every once in a while, I have this giant urge to go to New Mexico and hang out for a little bit, and then New Mexico just tells me it's over, and I come back home, and always want to come to the mountains here, which I got to do. But what I saw in 2008, Elizabeth Sims, who was a former president of the Southern Foodways Alliance and worked at the Biltmore Estate in Asheville, convened an 11-day event at the Biltmore Estate to talk about Appalachian food and foodways, both about the traditions and about what was happening in Asheville at that time. And Asheville is definitely in the Appalachian Mountains, very much an Appalachian town. It always fascinates me when people go to Asheville and say, well, this isn't really Appalachian. I'm like, what are you talking about? Here we are. It's 2016. This is Appalachia. You're just, you know, you're thinking that you're not just putting us in a geographic place. You're putting us in a time frame we haven't been in for decades. Yeah. So what was happening was that particularly kids who were coming out of Warren Wilson College, which is a sister school to Berea and has a very serious farm program there, they were still finding affordable land. Many of them were kids of families who had lived for generations in that region, and they were going back to the land, and they were starting growing – or not starting – but returning to growing sustainably, growing organically, pasturing animals in movable pastures, you know, going back to grass-fed and mast-fed animals and vegetables, and talking to farmers and their families who had never stopped saving seeds, growing heirlooms. They were learning, discovering things like candy roasters, which only grow in that region, and we are pretty sure are now our Cherokee cultivar, just original to here. So they were doing this work, and that was happening all across the country. You know, we were getting into this major locavore, sustainable, eat locally, grow naturally kind of movement. But in the other places across the United States, industrial agriculture had taken over farming by and large. And by industrial agriculture, I'm not just talking about farming. I'm talking about the harvesting of fish. I'm talking about game and ranching. Those wide open spaces that we associate with the Midwest and the West, and also a lot of areas of New York and Pennsylvania and Ohio, those had become factory type farms, and people, and there was a gap between generations, between these younger or newer people who wanted to return to an older method. In Appalachia, there was no gap. You didn't have to go look up in the library newspaper reports or records of what people were buying from the farm store in the 1800s. You could walk next door or call up your grandfather and ask, and they were still doing it. You didn't have to order your seeds from some seed company, you know, across the United States somewhere. You could hold out your hand and your grandmother would put the seeds that her family had been growing for generations in your hand. And I thought that that was a really wonderful opportunity for conversation, you know, an opportunity to talk about why this had continued. You know, part of it's our topography. I mean, we just, you know, we just can't do factory farming here. We can barely do farming. One of the things I love in this story, as I talk to people, is that everybody talks about their grandmother or grandfather having a garden. But in Appalachia, we talk about your grandmother's garden and your grandfather's garden. And often they had three or four because mm-hmm. they had to plant in different places right. around this rocky, slanty, broken up land. Mm-hmm. And one of my favorite stories I'll share with you was Bill Best talking about his grandmother planting vegetables along the fence of the road so that anyone walking by who might be hungry could pick the vegetables and eat them. And that, too, is a part of this story. Part of what I saw was a continuance of what I grew up with, which was a tremendous generosity of spirit about sharing knowledge and sharing what we grew and what we knew. And that's continuing in this younger generation also. So what I wanted to do with this book was to bring that past and the present together to talk, and in that conversation to imagine a future, which includes sustainable food as a piece of moving forward economically, one that makes us have to be conscious of preserving our land for farmers. In coal country, that means one thing. On the other side of the Blue Ridge, where tourism and second homes are major industry, that means setting land aside that cannot be taxed at the same level as it would be taxed to develop it. It means that we have to have some political action and consciousness here, but that we don't have to argue it anymore from don't run these farmers off because that would be a good thing to do. Mm-hmm. It's don't run farmers off because this is our economy going into the future.
So now we've just had the third Appalachian Food Summit.
Yes.
So we have a conference now where people are coming together and talking about these things. And with Vittles, I feel like we have the definitive book of the Appalachian food movement. So it just continues to grow.
Let me say one thing.
Okay.
That is a beautiful compliment, but this book, Vittles, is anything but definitive. Mm-hmm. It is the opening of a conversation. And we were talking about younger people coming in. There are writers. Yes. There are people with stories that are very different than the ones in this book. And what I hope with this book is that it opens the door for other people to tell their stories too. And I'll do everything I can to make sure that happens.
Do you have a favorite recipe in the book?
I often get asked this question. Mm-hmm. And so what I ask back is, what season is it?
Right.
You know? And if you open the book to this might be called the frontispiece, I'm not sure, but it's a two-page spread, and it shows the table that has, it's a summer table, a late spring, early summer table, and it has fried chicken and a pea salad with radishes on it, cucumbers, and sliced peppers, and a glass with trimmed green onions. I think we fudged the season a little because we've got some mighty pretty tomatoes in this picture with the peas and a spiced peach. But that would be the table we would have set in the summer, would have whatever was in the garden. It would have those green beans if they were full of beans in the pod cooked. It would have corn that had been cut off the cob and cooked in a skillet. It would have a squash casserole, depending upon what who was cooking, what your mother, your aunt, your great aunt, or your grandmother's favorite squash casserole was. And all those things would be on the table, but they would be supplemented by raw vegetables from the garden that we relished. And then we literally relished them later. We turned them into chow chows and pickles even pick-a-lily. I think that's I'd like to find the pick-a-lily pockets in Appalachia because that's not commonly said, but there are places that people did that too.
Well, I have a million more questions for you. I would just love to talk to you for two or three hours about all this stuff.
But we're too hungry to.
Right. And I know everybody out there listening is hungry now too. So thank you so much for being here with us.
Thank you, Ronnie Lundy. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me, Silas.
What a delight. And I can encourage everyone enough to go out and get a copy of her brand new book, Vittles, although you may have to spell it for the bookseller. It is the absolute perfect gift to buy for others. So if you want to get your holiday shopping done early, you really should seek it out. Buy yourself a copy too, though. And I know that there are going to be signed copies in the listening area because Ronnie Lundy is on book tour right now. She's visiting bookstores and is leaving signed copies there. So you'll be able to find those. So to sing us out, here's a song that's about biscuits. Until the next episode of Hillbilly Solid, be good to one another.